This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And of course, this is not easy. It took us 5 years to develop the technology, but now, yeah, we can tell that we turn trash into a long-lasting, sustainable product.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn about a small, innovative company that's recycling all sorts of plastics and turning them into gravel. We speak to the founder and CEO, Sebastian Sajou, about the technology and mission of his company, Arclight. Then, as the sunny days roll on this summer, we thought it worth revisiting our 2018 conversation with Craig Downs of the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory, about the havoc that far too many sunscreens wreak on fragile marine ecosystems. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the founder and CEO of Arclight, Sebastian Sajou. Sebastian, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here.
So we'll get into the technology in a second, Sebastian, but first, what's the mission of Arclight?
Well, our mission is to tackle plastic pollution. So we work on developing technologies to achieve this. And we do it by partnering with bigger organizations, by industry leaders, but also with the society. I don't know if you're aware, but every time you drop a piece of plastic on the bin, half of that, it's still going to end up in a landfill, on an incineration, or in the worst case, you know, on a water course and contaminating the environment. So that 50% of plastics that no one wants, that's our raw material. And our first product that it's the one we're producing here in California, it's a smart gravel that replaces mineral gravel in a variety of applications, right? We count on everyone going out there and buying a bag of Arclight smart gravel is automatically deviating all those pounds of plastics from the environment.
And you have kind of a multi-stage rollout plan for it. Why don't you kind of explain? Right now, you're going to be available for smaller consumer purchases, but it's going to be ramping up to bigger construction scale soon, right?
Yeah, totally. So when we started working on this solution, we were aiming for a large-scale solution for a large-scale problem. That's why we got to this idea of making gravel, right? So gravel has a great variety of applications and very different markets. From, let's say, starting from the bigger markets, you have concrete companies that are interested in making light concrete. So they replace the mineral gravel in the concrete mix by our gravel to get lighter materials and also the better insulative capacity of plastics in there, while also being able to offer a green concrete to their customers. Then you have like mid-sized markets, like the, for example, hydroponic growers that are using our gravel as a replacement of expanded clay because it's a great growth media for those systems. And then we also offer it on smaller bags on retail. It's already on the big box retailers for small home gardening projects, for also small hydroponics projects, and also small contractors using the gravel. So you'll see it online on the big retailers, and you can also see it maybe, you know, on a big Cemex concrete truck just on the road.
Now let's dive into the process of upcycling that Arclight has developed. Why don't you kind of walk us through how it might work from somebody using a plastic container that gets rejected by their waste management company and how it might get into your company's hands and how you'd utilize it?
Yeah, sure. So we get the plastics from two main streams. One is post-industrial, and that is manufacturers of different types of plastics that are non-recyclable, and for that I could say potato chips bags, I don't know, cookies, wrappers for energy bars, all those films that we see on the products that we eat, for example, every day, because they have several layers of different plastics that protect the product for a longer time. So they're already born unrecyclable. So the more, let's say, environmentally aware companies manufacturing these materials, they don't want to send all this crap, all the leftovers to a landfill, so they send it to us. And same thing happens on the post-consumer side, where we partner with MRFs and with other recyclers that are picking the good plastics that have a commodity value, and then they have no other choice than sending those plastics to the remaining plastics to a landfill, right? So we do offer that as a service. So it's pretty special, because we have a double revenue model where we charge for the solution and we compete against a landfill, and we offer a price competitive option and a sustainable option at the end of the day. Just to give you a general idea of what happens with those plastics when they get here, we classify them, we grind all the plastics, we clean them, we remove any leftovers of organics or any other contaminants that they may have, and then we heat them at really high temperatures to remove any other bacteria. So we stabilize the plastic, and at the end of the day, at the end of the process, you get this gravel which is stabilized, and that assures that it will be long-lasting, that it won't leach anything, that it won't break down into microplastics. And of course, this is not easy. It took us 5 years to develop the technology, but now, yeah, we can tell that we turn trash into a long-lasting, sustainable product.
And in terms of application, is this gravel different than other gravel? Like, can it not be used in highways, etc.?
Well, the main difference is, there are two main differences. One is weight, right? This is very, very light. So compared to mineral gravel that is really heavy, we can offer that benefit. And that's, of course, useful if you're looking for that. If you want to do, for example, a light concrete, then you want to replace mineral gravel with our gravel. But if you're looking for example, compressive strength, then you want to go for mineral gravel, standard gravel, because there's nothing, you know, harder than that. So we offer flexibility, which is very much appreciated in civil engineering applications, lightweight, and great insulation. So depending on the use you want to do for it, for example, there's people just buying the gravel because just going to the store, grabbing a 50 liter or a big bag of gravel, it's very heavy, it's very difficult to transport, to handle, and even to install. It's also dirty. And when you buy our smart gravel, you can carry a couple of bags because it's three times lighter, it's clean, and at the end of the day, you are helping the environment. So that's kind of, depending on what you're doing, how you will be able to benefit from it.
And in terms of procuring the plastics, you mentioned how you can get like these films that might get thrown away otherwise. How do you compete with like the landfills for these products? How do you ensure that you can get a steady flow, a steady supply of these recyclable plastics?
Well, first of all, economics. We charge less than a landfill. So that's one of the main difference between our technologies and other technologies out there. We are very cost efficient. So that's the main driver. And also companies sending those plastics to us, besides maybe saving a penny, they get access to incentives, to subsidies or tax credits or other benefits that are associated with their industry because they are improving their sustainability metrics. So it's a win however you look at it.
So the gravel itself can be used for what exactly? Is this something that people would put into their gardens or their driveways or what?
Just to mention a couple of applications, let's say you're growing hydroponics with a hydroponic system, you use expanded clay as a growth media. So the plants will grab from the expanded clay and they will grow feeding from the water that runs through that expanded clay. If you replace that expanded clay, which is a traditional system, with our gravel, then you'll get a clean system, because this gravel, our gravel, won't break down into smaller parts or won't generate any dust, keeping all the systems clean. And on top of that, because it's not porous, if you ever get like some type of pest in the water, you just remove it, wash it, and you can reuse it many times, compared to expanded clay, where you would need to just toss all the expanded clay and buy a new batch and install it again. So that's, for example, hydroponics. And then home gardening, the most traditional use is to help avoid root rot, which is something very common among people that loves gardening. And so you want, if you set a layer of smart gravel at the bottom of your pots, then you will allow the water to drain more efficiently out of the pot, and your plants will grow bigger and healthier. So that's for the most common home applications.
Green plastic watering can, for a fake Chinese rubber plant. And the fake plastic cup, that you bought from a rubber man, in a town full of rubber plants, to get rid. She lives with a broken mind, a cracked polystyrene. This
is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Sebastian Sajou. He is the founder and CEO of ArcLight. People can go to ArcLight, that's ArcLite.com, to check it out. So, Sebastian, you were mentioning how you have different product offerings at a different scale level on the horizon. Are there any plans for your company to expand the range of plastics that can be recycled?
So the crazy thing here is that we are already recycling every type of plastic. So that the magic of the technology is that we can mix everything together and turn that into a new plastic polymer that we can mold into different things. So maybe the challenge is not adding new plastics, but adding new products to the products that we are offering. So because we're already related and working a lot with the construction industry, with landscapers and architects and urban developers, we're already working on new products for those categories, like other fibers to be used for concrete, blocks for emergency housing, and ready mix concrete, so you can make a light and an eco-friendly ready mix at home. So there are other things that we're working in partnerships with bigger companies that are leaders in the market.
And can you kind of give us a snapshot of the competitive landscape? You have your own technology, but there are other companies that take plastic and use it for industrial purposes. Do you work directly with the waste management company or not?
Well, yes, we work with them because the process begins with an analysis of the plastics available, the amount of plastic they have, how contaminated they are. So we do tailor a solution for them, and then work on a long-term agreement so we can both get benefited from the relationship. And I would say that at this point, we are the only ones taking these unrecyclable, or let's say hard to recycle plastics, and processing them at a rate of 1 ton per hour and turning that into an efficient product for a massive market. So we have covered all the angles because we have a good technology, we have a market that doesn't generate any bottleneck for the product, which is sometimes something that affects great ideas, because then the market is maybe not ready for the final product resulting of a great technology. And the other thing would be the low cost, because all other technologies out there which are great, like really, really amazing, like the polymerizing the plastics and other things like that, then they are still in a lab scale and they're very, very expensive. So it's still, you know, they're a little bit green yet, and they are where we were 5 years ago when we started.
So if people are interested in this technology and they want to invest in it somehow or get involved, how can they do that, Sebastian?
Well, we're now offering people willing to have a more active role on this type of solution the possibility to own a part of the technology by participating on a WeFunder campaign. We've been there for 4 weeks already, and we're close to the final goal, and we think it's a good way of, you know, engaging and building the community we want to build.
He's the CEO and founder of ArcLite. People can go to ARQLITE.com to learn more. Sebastian Sajou. Sebastian, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks to you, Alex. Pleasure.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by Craig Downs. Craig is the executive director of the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. Craig, welcome to SeaChange Radio.
Thank you for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
So for our listeners, what is the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory? It's a great name. Maybe give us also a little bit of the background of that.
All right. We are a 501c3 nonprofit science and education organization. We do pretty much pro bono forensic investigations around the world for people and environments that can't defend themselves. So we'll look at coral reefs to wetlands that are dying. Nobody knows what they're dying from, and we'll figure out what they're dying from. And then we will work with grassroots organizations all the way up to international NGOs and governments to change the condition of that environment or that population.
And where does the name Hereticus come from?
Hereticus comes from the Greek word heresy or heretic. And it originally means to, once you know something, you can choose to do something. So an oil executive that we were working with told me that if we were to begin to do pro bono cases, that we would be a heretic to the industry. And I like that concept so much that that's what we named our organization.
So you've been working on research and trying to raise awareness of the role that sunscreen is playing, certain sunscreens are playing in killing off coral reefs. Why don't you first explain what types of sunscreens we're looking at and maybe give us kind of the beginnings of the research, if you will.
So we were tasked back in 2005, 2006 by the U.S. National Park Service to begin figuring out why certain coral reefs were dying and not recovering in one of their national parks, the Virgin Islands National Park in St. John, U.S. Virgin Islands. And one of the most famous beaches, Trunk Bay, we discovered that it was sunscreen pollution as the dominant stressor that was killing the reef and suppressing the restoration of that reef. And when we sampled the water, one of the most prominent chemicals out of our assessment was the chemical oxybenzone. And at the time, oxybenzone was in almost every sunscreen out there. It was the dominant UV protector in Banana Boat, Coppertone, and everybody was using it. So we found that oxybenzone and sunscreen pollution all over the world, in places such as Palau, Hawaii, Mexico, Belize, Spain, Israel, Persian Gulf. So it's it's all over the place, and it's not on every single coral reef in the world, but it's on coral reefs where people go. It's on coral reefs that's important for tourism. And the sunscreen pollution is a symptom of unmanaged or unsustainable tourism. And that's one of the big take-home lessons out of this whole topic, is tourism is what starts it, and tourism can fix it, meaning that sustainable tourism can be implemented and people can enjoy these coral reefs. They can participate in these reefs and in these natural resources if they do certain precautionary measures.
Such as?
So there are at least three things that we can think of as a precautionary measure. You need to protect yourself from the sun. So public health is critical. You need to protect yourself from UV radiation. But oxybenzone sunscreen, which is one of the most dangerous of the chemicals in sunscreen pollution, doesn't have to be a part of that solution. It doesn't have to be a part of that problem. So the first thing we recommend is to cover up. If you're going to be out on the reef and you're going to be swimming, wear a sun shirt. It doesn't have to be a tight rash guard. There are a whole bunch of companies out there, Mott 50, Land's End, J. Crew, that sell looser fitting shirts than surfer rash guards that you can wear in the water and then, you know, go up to the beach with it and go up to the cafe or the cabana and wear it on you and not have to lose the protection against the UV radiation, as well as being able to reduce your sunscreen pollution load by 50%. If you're wearing a sun shirt that has sleeves, that means you're not putting sunscreen lotion on your body in that area. That 50% reduction or more is a big conservation deal. It's a major conservation tool. The second thing you can do is to wear sunscreens that don't contain some of these more toxic chemicals, such as oxybenzone, actinosate, or contain preservatives like butylparaben or propylparaben or methylparaben. The parabens are actually endocrine disruptors. And many invertebrates use methylparaben as a pheromone. So the presence of these parabens are pretty bad. They're endocrine disruptors. And they can cause a loss of populations from prohibiting the development of a number of invertebrates in that area. Invertebrates like shrimp, like sea urchins, Christmas tree worms, there are about 1,000 more organisms on any given coral reef, especially invertebrate organisms, than just coral. Sea urchins are a big deal. Sea stars are a big deal. Feather worms, sea cucumbers, crabs, shrimp.
The whole ecosystem there.
The whole ecosystem, especially the invertebrates, are susceptible to these chemicals. So wearing sunscreen lotions that don't contain these chemicals, again, is a big conservation tool in mitigating that pollution. Haere mai tau a piti, te rara mohi nandi se, e la pa ala sante. Aue te nehe nehe, tohe poro iti e, jahi ohi amai, ena te a te a e. Haere mai tau a piti, te rara mohi nandi se, e la pa ala sante.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Craig Downs of the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. So, Craig, when I first heard about Hawaii banning sunscreens, and I want to dive into that in a second, my first reaction was, well, how can just a small amount of lotion that we may slather onto our bodies affect a coral reef, which is can be many, many thousands of square feet and has the ocean tides coming in and out. And when you think of the volume of water versus the amount of even the most pernicious sunscreen, it seems like a small amount. But you and your team have come across some interesting data that shows that even these relatively small amounts matter quite a bit, don't they?
Yes. And so It's a really good question, and there's a number of perspectives associated with that question. First of all, you don't put on a little bit of sunscreen to protect yourself. That's actually a clinical problem called sunscreen abuse. An average person wearing a bikini or normal-sized swim trunks, they need to put on about 36 grams of sunscreen every hour and a half and then reapply. And so if you're putting 36 grams of sunscreen in your normal-sized person and you're getting in the water and you're in the water for 4 hours, you know, you're looking at about 72 grams of sunscreen. That's just you. Now multiply that by 500 to 1,000 people getting into the water in that day, every single day. It adds up. And oxybenzone is a persistent organopollutant. It will hang around from 90 days to 2.5 years. It doesn't break down.
And the tides don't wash it away, huh?
Well, not really. I mean, you got something called retention. And especially if you're in a bay or lagoon, that water is kept in that place. That's where the coral reefs are, and that's where people want to swim.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a offshore coral reef, seeing lots of heavy current and a lot of waves, you're not going to get a lot of people swimming there. And the coral reefs that see a lot of people are these fringing reefs. Fringing reefs are reefs that surround the coastline, that are on the coastline, and they can get up right to the beach.
Craig, maybe you can tell our listeners some ways that they might be able to take action to help the cause of banning these harmful sunscreen ingredients.
One of the easiest ways they can get involved is they can go to change.org. And we have a citizen's petition to the Food and Drug Administration asking the FDA to re-review the safety of oxybenzone and actinosate. And if we can get 1,500 signatures from U.S. citizens, what we're hoping to do is to provide that petition to a congresswoman or a senator, and to personally then give that petition over to Commissioner Gottlieb of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to let the FDA know that we're serious, that the American people don't want to be poisoned anymore unnecessarily. And it's not just the, you know, people are being exposed not just from cosmetic products. It's in our food. All that sunscreen, all that oxybenzone is getting in the fish that we eat. It's getting into the plants that we eat. It's getting into the water we drink. So it's now a universal environmental contaminant, and we really need to do something about it.
Craig Downs is the executive director of the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. Craig, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Temptations, Radiohead, and the Ka'au Crater Boys.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.